Welcome to Fired Up Conservative Talk, where we are hotter than Hezbollah's pagers after Israel's latest tech update. Folks, it seems the Israeli Defense Force has decided to take their war on terror to the next level by turning everyday communication devices into impromptu fireworks displays. Who needs missiles when you can just page your enemies into oblivion, right? In this Tom Clancy-esque thrilling new chapter of Middle Eastern diplomacy, Israel's defense minister is calling for bravery, resolve, and tenacity, because apparently blowing up pagers requires the determination of a telemarketer. And let's not forget Hezbollah's promise of special retribution. I guess regular retribution just doesn't cut it anymore in the age of smart bombs and exploding flip phones. With tens of thousands evacuated from border areas, it's clear that this conflict is reaching new heights. Or should I say, new frequencies. One thing's for sure, the next time your boss pages you, you might want to think twice before answering. And some words of wisdom. Maybe it's time for Hezbollah to find a new service provider. We're also diving into a world where the Fed thinks lowering rates will magically make houses affordable, because nothing says the American dream like a slightly less impossible mortgage. We'll then zoom in on Carlsbad, California, because despite the Fed's rate cuts, Carlsbad's housing market remains a playground for the well-off, with median home values soaring to $1.5 million. Even with slightly lower interest rates, the average Joe would need to win the lottery twice just to afford a down payment in this coastal paradise. We'll also talk on the Homes Act. In this absurd plan, AOC's belief in treating housing as a right. That's right, as a right, could obliterate the housing industry, leaving us with a landscape where only public housing exists. Imagine waiting lists longer than the Great Wall of China. We'll also update you on Newsom's veto of free home loans for illegal immigrants. Apparently, even California has limits to its generosity. Who knew? Wait, it's an election year. Maybe Newsom's developed an acute case of voter sensitivity. I guess his political GPS recalculated and found a route away from Free Houses for All Boulevard. Then we'll discuss how Democrat rhetoric is turning into a game of pin the death threat on the conservative, because nothing says democracy like intimidating your opponents with assassination attempts. And finally, we'll look at Newsom's latest bill signing, which aims to keep AI from lying about politicians, because if anyone's going to spread misinformation about candidates, it should be the candidates themselves. Kamala. So buckle up, patriots. It's time to get fired up. Everybody, this is William Del Pilar, and this is Fired Up, and I'm here with my co-host G. Mangani and Ms. Annette Ross. Today we have a special episode. We've decided to go long form to take Annette Ross's forms and talk about the topics that are hitting us hard, and that includes the Fed rate cut. And we have a special guest with us tonight, and he is a candidate for Carlsbad, California's City Council. And with that, I want to welcome Tyler Collins aboard. Tyler, my friend, it's good to see you. And for G and Annette, if you do not know Tyler, Tyler, as I said, is a candidate for the Carlsbad City Council. Tyler, if you can introduce yourself here real quick, as well as giving a plug to where people can go find out more info about you and donate.
Great. Appreciate it. Thank you, William. So happy to be here today. So my name is Tyler Collins, and I'm a candidate for Carlsbad City Council. So I'm an engineer by trade, and I stepped up to the plate because I wanted to have someone to represent our city who's grown up in Southern Coastal California. I've also served as chair of the Carlsbad Housing Commission for about a year. So that's the experience I bring, and I'm happy to talk about housing issues on today's podcast. Thank you, William.
Right. So Tyler's going to be with us for the whole show. So to pump myself up, built up a nice little segment around Tyler there, so we can talk about the Fed rate cut with our econ guru G, and the zero in on Carlsbad, which is where he's running. It's Carlsbad, for y'all that don't know, is a beautiful coastal area. It's out of my price range, damn it, but it's beautiful, and it's a great place to go if you're a tourist. They have a long, beautiful, what would they call that, guys? A walkway, with, you know, the one by the ocean. What's that called? It's like a big, long sidewalk by the ocean.
The village is what it's best known for. It's got a lot of unique, small, family-owned restaurants. There's a lot of history. We're very proud of our town.
So. A pier? William, a pier?
That would be the Oceanside Pier. That's another area that's really gotten nicely revamped. Our producer says Riverwalk. I've never heard that one. Let's just put it this way. When you go there, you can't miss it, and it's a beautiful walk, especially if you have dogs. For the locals, we go there at times on Sundays and just enjoy the beautiful scenery. And Tyler's right. It's a beautiful area to go to if you're a tourist. Well, let's get right on into it. Gene, you can take a few seconds to introduce yourself, and then Miss Annette, and I want to jump right into some of these topics before we get into the Fed rate cut.
Yeah, G. Mangani here, and I'm an elected board member to the Rancho Santa Fe School District, where you might think it's a small town in the suburb of San Diego and nothing ever happens there, but it's never boring over here in the school district.
It's Annette.
That is so true. I'm the current president of the Rancho Santa Fe School Board. I'm seeking re-election and the author of the book Where Fairy Tales Go.
Outstanding. All right. So, guys, before we get into the Fed rate cut, I wanted to give an update on California Assembly Bill 1840. And the reason this is important for the whole nation is this is people don't realize that our Congress has tried to push many of these legislative actions that California has done here and passed. Now, in Congress, they have not passed any of them so far. Fingers crossed they won't. But this is important because it was a bill that would have allowed some undocumented immigrants to qualify for state-backed loans. We talked about this, was it maybe 3 weeks ago? The loans could have been up to about $150,000, if I remember correctly. It passed the state legislature in late August. I believe this was whacked because it's an election year. Annette, your take on this bill being vetoed?
Wait, why am I first tonight, William?
Ladies first. Actually, I think you're being ganged up here with three men, huh? Where's Bill?
Yeah, I feel like go ahead, re-ask the question for me, William. I didn't think I was going to be called up first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so this was the bill that would have qualified some illegals to qualify to get literally free money to buy a home. So Newsom said it was because of budget constraints, the reason for vetoing it. However, given the current political climate and Newsom's own political national ambitions, to what extent do you think this veto was more strategic because of the elections and his own future versus the actual budget?
No, thank you for clarifying the question. I think it was 100% strategic and political and par for the course with him. I think that we didn't like it when we talked about it a few weeks ago and we thought it didn't make a lot of sense budget-wise, but it sounds really good in a soundbite that we're going to try to help people and all of that goodwill. But I think that they realized quite quickly that it wasn't going to be something that they could actually, fulfill for people, and it didn't make a lot of sense with their current deficit in California. It makes absolutely no sense. It makes absolutely no budgetary sense at all. So I think that it was easy for him to slide into a different position.
You know, I totally agree. I think that pretty much sums it up in a nutshell. Anything to add to that, Mr. Mangani?
Well, I think if I can veer outside of the topic for a second. I think Newsom wants to run for president.
Correct.
So this guy was barnstorming across the country for Joe Biden, and Joe Biden resigns, and 15 minutes later, or not resigns, but he jumps out of the race, and 15 minutes later endorses Kamala Harris, which I think she had some goods on him or something, and totally took the rug out from under Governor Newsom, right? So he has not held one campaign rally for Kamala Harris. He doesn't want to, right? Because he wants to run in 2028. If she wins, he doesn't get to do anything till 2032. And then by then, we'll have 8 years of Democratic rule. And he's like, okay, that's going to be a crapshoot at that point, right? So I think his calculus is he needs to gear himself for a 2028 run, and he wants Kamala to lose. I think he would rather have 4 years of Donald Trump, and then he gets a shot in 2028. So he has to think about what he's doing here right now, right? So what we talked about 3 weeks ago, and if I remember my numbers right, 18,000 families signed up for this home loan last year, and that's legal residents, and only 1,800 got it, so 10%, right? So now if you flood the 18,000 with more families trying to apply for it and they don't actually belong in this country because they came here illegally, then even fewer people will get this money. So absolutely, I think it's a political move. He's thinking 4 years from now.
Wait, can I say something about Lucas William? Because they're so ruthless. They're so ruthless. And so, no, they are, though, and so calculating. Because I saw him on some podcast. Gee, you make such a good point. Because I saw him on some podcast after that, and he was – is the current term like butthurt? I'm sorry. Is that, like, inappropriate? But he was so, like
– oh, I love it. Love
he
it.
Was so upset. And then
Gen Z is on to some other lingo. That's like a millennial thing.
I have – I know. It's the girls. Okay.
It's a good one. No. That's actually one of my favorite terms that I actually hold off on saying. I wouldn't have said it because we have a lady in our presence, but look at that, it was a lady.
Sorry.
Who said it.
I'm 19-year-old daughters.
It's a popular term when I was in the Navy. What's the matter? Yeah. You butt hurt? You're just whining, you know? So, Tyler, you know, this underscores the contentious nature of the immigration policy in California. We're a sanctuary state, but with all the rampant crime, everything going south right now, it's not good. It's not a good time to be an illegal alien right now compared to a year ago. This reflects the challenges of addressing housing issues in a state that's arguably one of the highest cost of living states in the country. Do you think this was the right move politically for him to make? I don't want to pin you in. So what are your thoughts in general on this bill being vetoed and excluding illegal? Smart move politically, or do you believe it was because of the budget?
I do think this was the right move for Newsom to make politically. If we're talking strictly from the sense of a presidential election that he wants to have, in the contingency that Kamala loses. So because he's got to now try to appear moderate, you know, after all these years of certain policies he's pushed, now he's got to kind of take it back and tell all of America, not just California, but Ohio and Pennsylvania and all these other states that aren't exactly like California. Well, hey, you know, I'm an all-American person after all, and I can be this more center candidate. So this is the start, really, of his shift towards that and posturing.
You know, it's a great victory, I think, for America, for him to veto it, you know, when it's all said and done, because this, like I said, there's like, for example, AB5. People don't realize that died in the committee, but they talked about it. They tried to push that through to make that a national issue, and that's the gig worker. And so these bad policies aren't just limited for here. All right, that's an update we wanted to give you on that. Before I hand it over to G, I wanted to talk about here briefly the Fed's half-point Hail Mary, hoping to turn the housing market frowns upside down. God, I hope people can get my wit. So right now, Zillow data shows a shortfall of about 4.5 million homes in 2022, up from 4.3 million in 2021. Now, if you're wondering, well, why is he talking about 2022? You know, it takes time to gather this data. But let's just put it this way. We got tons of millions and millions of homes in terms of a shortage. The U.S. housing market is experiencing a crisis of affordability affecting both renters and potential home buyers across the country. And most people don't think of renters, but they are affected as well. There's tens of millions of households in the U.S. are spending more than 30% of their income on housing, which is considered unaffordable. Now, to put it in perspective, 30% of your paycheck, that's like the high end of what most people will pay on a monthly basis for their homes. So technically that's still the normal threshold, but odds are that most are spending about 33%, which is above that high end threshold. And in some extreme cases, 40 to 50%. People just can't afford to buy homes. In fact, there's a lot of times where the homes are in escrow being waiting to be bought. And then all of a sudden it's not just the payment, the monthly payment, then the insurance that goes with it. It just becomes terrible. Before I turn it over to you, G, let's get the group here. How does this, and we'll start with you, G, how does this ongoing housing crisis with the rising costs, a shortage of homes, affect a person's ability to build wealth and improve their lives? I mean, it's a pretty basic answer. I mean, how? You're our economic guru.
Yeah. COVID really did a number on our health, but also on our economy, right? So if you think of housing during that time, I believe nationwide they built 25 million units across the country. During that year, I think they built less than 5 million. And that was, you know, between January and March. And then the economy shut down. So they have a deficit of at least 20 million, assuming that they were able to ramp back up during the pandemic. And it was only 2020 that they didn't get to build those extra 20 million units. Now they have, assuming that they were able to ramp back up in 2021 and assuming that they're able to ramp up from a normal basis, just 10%, it would take 10 years to make up those 20 million units. So we're really down a lot with housing. And you know, the Kamala was talking about, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, Kamala was talking about, well, let's just give new first time home buyers $25,000 to buy their first home, which is the wrong policy, right? That will just lead to more inflation. What the policy should be is let's just try to remove all the regulations to all these home builders. Responsibly, not just building homes on top of each other, but responsibly, with proper planning, build as many homes as we can as possible. And that's what will solve this crisis.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. We are in a tough situation as a nation, and in California, it's even worse. I mean, home prices have surged about 30% since 2020. The typical home price has increased from $332,000 to $430,000. Now, I know where I live in Valley Center, it's a rural area. Our homes are above $700,000 a pop, you know, and it just, where does it end? I mean, what are your thoughts on this, Annette?
Well, I don't want to be just, first of all, it's untenable. And I think also people are also taking advantage, especially of the renters, because some of these places were bought a long time ago, and they said they just increased the rents beyond any sort of real affordability or fairness or reasonability for people. But and I say it's anecdotal, like because I have kids that are a little bit older, and because I know so many people my age who have children that are now getting into New York, getting into Chicago, getting into San Diego, and none of them are living on their own. They all have jobs, William, and they can't make their rent. The parents are supporting all of it. I can't think of one kid I know out of college with a job, so they're employed, trying to make it, get an apartment. We're starting small there, and I'm not talking about homes right now, but just talking about trying to live, that they can make it without their parental support. It wasn't that way before. I didn't need my parents' support for my apartment. I could do it. I could make it with the job that I had. I didn't have to work three jobs. I had to work one job, and I had one apartment, and it was okay, and I could make it work. I don't think that that is an untenable situation for these kids that are getting jobs, leaving college, and going out there and trying to find housing. So I guess I'm not really talking about, like, the families. I don't know how they do it at all. But now I don't know how, like, that seems almost like an impossible thing to me. But it seems like for the kids that are coming out of college and they're trying to get their lives started, they're not doing it anymore without their parents' support. They can't make it.
I agree. And to G and Tyler, you know, when I was doing my research for this, I should not have been shocked. I always assumed it was higher. But to sit there and see the median price, G and Tyler, for a home in Carlsbad being $1.5 million, it's like, thank God you're an engineer, Tyler.
Count my lucky stars. That's right. And I'm married. I couldn't imagine if it was just me trying to do this. As it is with my wife and I, who both have good jobs, we were barely able to get on the base rung of the housing ladder in Carlsbad. We applied for one of the cheapest townhouses in one of the least expensive parts of the city. And even then, that was close to $1 million. So that's where we're at. It's an unfortunate situation. And I totally agree with those feelings that Amanda's having. And I have a lot of stories of friends and family. It's the same deal. It's very upsetting. Yeah.
So Tyler, in terms of Carlsbad, do you have a sense on what the rental market looks like in terms of a townhouse? What would that rent for? Or a single family home around 2,500 square feet to 3,000 square feet? What would something like that rent for right now? Do you have an idea?
So in terms of rentals, the closest I'd have is when I was actually renting. So that would have been last October that we last, when we actually moved out and bought our house. And I believe at that time we were in kind of South Carlsbad, inland from the coast a little bit. So probably a moderate range unit. And that would have been, I think it was a two bed, two bath, I think around like $3,200 a month. So that, and it's probably gone up, you know, a couple percent since then. So, but that's probably a good estimate where you're at with two bed, two bath. So,
and I believe a townhouse, $1 million mortgage, or let's say $800,000, that would be about $5,000 a month, I would imagine. So we're talking that it's much cheaper to rent than it is to actually own. And if we can get the producer to show my screen. There we go. So I love Pinkerton. I'm going to make this a little bigger here. I've been going to this website since 2004 when I first started looking for a house. And if you look at this time, I came here and I saw this chart right here, and I don't think you can see my mouse. So there we go. All right. So this is right when I came to the website, and I'm like, holy moly, this, the house prices in comparison to rent is just way too high, right? And what do we see? This big crash after that, which we all know during the great financial crisis happened in 2009. But now we're back to those levels again. And what's your take in Carlsbad in terms of how sustainable this is and how do you get out of this, right? You said you're on the housing commission. And this is San Diego wide, right? But how do you alleviate the pressure in just your area that, you have, little bit of influence over?
Great. That's a great question. And I've learned a lot being chair of the Housing Commission. And when we look at these numbers, it's pretty staggering, the scale of this problem. And it really has to be a countywide and a statewide response, because we, as a city alone, Carlsbad is not going to solve the housing crisis. I think we have to build housing for, you know, especially children of the people who grew up here. They have multiple generations of families, and it's tragic when I hear, you know, my neighbors, their kids, they've moved to Texas or they moved to Florida because they can't afford to live here. It's very sad. But I think we also need to be mindful about preserving our neighborhoods and the quality of life for existing residents. So I think we should pursue a policy of smart growth. California has given us certain mandates that we have to follow in terms of housing production. And as a city council member, my initiative would be to stick to the letter of that law as we are required to, but try to build them to the best of our ability, not impacting existing residents. So put them in transit corridors, put them where we have existing transit connections and services that it doesn't impact our existing single-family neighborhoods.
Right, and then the California passed, I believe it was a couple of years ago, SB9. And SB9 basically says that you can build additional units on a particular lot, right? So you can subdivide and build additional housing for, let's say, granny flat or whatnot. I believe that's more for the more rural areas because they're, you know, the lot sizes are bigger or whatnot. Carlsbad, what's your average lot size? Maybe a quarter acre. So does that apply to Carlsbad? Is there any discussion on the Housing Commission in terms of how can we entice homeowners to build ADUs, or is your density too high to even have a real discussion around that?
So that's another great question. So we do have quite high density here if you compare that out to like a Valley Center or somewhere else like this. Or you look at the average density of Carlsbad today versus 30 years ago when there was, you know, way less than there is now. Now, I do believe that SB 9 still does apply. I think that application of SB 9 is independent of lot size. Now, you do have to comply with certain setbacks and things like that. But the ability to build an ADU is not dependent solely on the lot size itself. And yes, I would think Carlsbad definitely has smaller lots on average than a Valley Center or things that are zoned like residential, agricultural, that sort of deal. And so in terms of what is the city doing about this, we've also, like I said, the state has given us certain mandates. One of those things is to provide pre-approved templates for ADUs. So we have, per the state guidelines, we need to give a selection of designs that are pre-approved, that'll be streamlined for approval, permits, and all of that, so that people can have a selection of things to choose from to build. It'll make actually building those ADUs cheaper and more affordable for people.
Yeah, and I have a friend who, and I believe this is the actual floor plan by the developer, but they live in Carmel Valley, and that's about as cookie cutter. And this is in the days of not where you could touch your neighbor's house outside the window. It's you could touch each other's fingers, or you're both reaching out. So it's a little further back. I believe it was built in the late 90s. But so above his garage, which is a detached garage, they have a granny flat. And I think that was part of the developer floor plan. I don't know if it was like a what do you call it, an option, or whether that just came standard. But he has that thing rented out all the time. It's amazing. It generates additional income, and, you know, his house since he bought it has maybe quadrupled or quintupled in value, something like that. Probably bought it for $400,000 and probably worth $2 million now. So I think ADUs are part of the solution to the problem, but I definitely think we should have the county approve building permits far east. I mean, when I drive out to Arizona or I drive up to Las Vegas, all I see is empty land everywhere, right? And some of it's hilly, but then once you get past the hill, there's flat land that could be developed on. And with the amount of work from home labor workforce out there, I think it's a little more plausible. I do want to show one more thing before we move on from the subject, but I pulled up this mortgage refinance index, and this is from the pandemic to now. And when you see that a lot of people refinanced during the lowest rates, right? Mm-hmm. And the Fed funds rate was near zero, and mortgage rates, I refinanced probably around here, November, December 2020. And my 30-year fix is 2.75%. I'm never giving that mortgage up. I mean, and I'm not selling my house ever. I think I'm going to die in my house and let my children inherit it so they can get the stuff up from basis. But I think there's a lot of people have the golden handcuffs of their homes, right? They got the low mortgage rate and they've got the capital gains that they'll have to pay taxes on, which is not.
That made a really weird situation in the housing market, because when this happened, there were a lot of young people who were betting that rates go up and prices drop, but that isn't what happened. We saw stagnation of price growth. Mm-hmm. They had been exploding during COVID when rates had been dropping. And then the Fed raised rates. Price growth stalled, but it didn't drop like people thought. There was no housing crash. This was not 2008 again. But it's a lot of that contributes or was caused by what you're talking about, that people refied for 2.75%. And they said, well, why would I sell my house? I'm just going to have to buy another house and refi for 7.5% or 7%. So the supply side of houses wasn't there, even though the demand fell in terms of buyers because the rates were so much higher. The supply had also fell because no one wanted to get out of the market because they didn't want to get into a huge expensive loan.
That's right. And when you're, the tax-free gain on your house is limited to, if you're married, $500,000, right? So if your house appreciates more than $500,000, you sell the house to move into a bigger house or downsize into a smaller house, you have to pay tax on that excess gain. The policy needs to change. That gain should be tax-free, either at a higher limit or just remove the taxes at, you know, once if you roll it into a house, like a 1031 exchange. So, and I apologize, you couldn't see the chart, but here you can see once the Federal Reserve started raising the rates right around here, March, April, I mean, the refinance boom just ended. So it's just been dead ever since. But William, back to you.
Wait, William, I gotta say something.
Go ahead.
This is so quick. I have to say it. Tyler, you made me think of something when you were talking. I know you guys don't care about this. We're talking about the financial piece of it. I know you guys don't care about this, but also, as a woman and as a mother and someone who cares about the home that my children are raised in, we're talking a little bit also about the uglification of California. These people do not, thank you, Tyler, for shaking your head. It's true. They don't care about what they're building. A lot of it's crap. It's cheap and it looks terrible. I'm sorry. And nobody would want to live in it. And they're asking us to pay high prices and accept that standard of low quality material. I'm sorry, but it's true. William, it's true.
Sorry. No. You are absolutely right. As somebody who did serve, I proudly say that, is projects that were approved 20 years ago. California is so slow that when I served from 2016 to 2020, projects from the late 90s, early 2000s that were approved because of CEQA, lawsuits, everything activists would do to stop it, they finally would come in front of us. And what people didn't understand is we had no power. They already approved. The houses were coming. We would fight in terms of how these houses would look. The design. Those are simple things that people don't think about. And when you think of politics, you think of Trump, Biden, Kamala. You don't think of those little things, but at a local level, that's what we fight for. So the community has a certain look. Now there's both good and bad about it. Some people want a certain look and they don't want to veer from it and they don't want to compromise because everything's a compromise. But no, Annette, you are absolutely correct. If the builders had their way, it'd be the cheapest, templated cookie cutter homes. Now that said, in Tyler's case, Carlsbad is a beautiful area. All coastal areas up and down the East and West Coast tend to be a little bit more unique. And in fact, what most people don't realize, and Tyler could probably attest to this too, is they don't really build new homes in these coastal areas. Instead, what happens is these homes from the 50s, these wood stories, little cute homey homes, is when a new buyer comes in, they literally destroy them. They rip them from the foundation and they kind of build them up to where it's kind of like a skyscraper. The home is bigger, but it's because it's growing up, not out, because that's how tight land is there. Any final words from your end, Tyler, in regards to the housing community in Carlsbad before we move on to the national level of this?
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what Annette said, that the aesthetics of the places that we're building that are the fabric of our community that we're interacting with on a daily basis, it's really important, people, because this is where they live. And if someone builds up some ugly mid-rise, that's just destroying the visual fabric of the community. And that's completely clashing with the identity of a place. And so to the power possible within the city council and planning commission, I think we should strive for that new construction should be congruent with the architecture and should be congruent with the aesthetics of the city. So I think that was a great point.
Exactly, I agree.
William complains when I'm on the show because I'm too agreeable. So I'll have to think of some points.
Tyler, I just want a solid door, not a plastic door. I just think that even though I grew up on the south side of Chicago, at least the doors were solid wood.
Well, heck, at least you had a door in the south side of Chicago.
True.
Okay, the Homes Act. This is a national act that has been introduced. The Homes Act, because who needs a housing market when you can just decommodify your way to homelessness? So the Homes Act was introduced on September 18th, 2024 by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. and Senator Smith. And it proposes a significant shift in addressing the U.S. housing crisis. This is, I'm trying to figure out a way to put it in layman terms. This is a home is a right, and we are going to control the market type bill. And what I find extremely shameful, and I say this in all seriousness, is AOC is an econ major. And this bill is a disgrace to every economist out there. So what this legislation does, it recognizes that market-based solutions alone are not sufficient. In other words, the free market is not good enough and that government intervention is necessary. And what she fails to realize here is it's all the government regulation, all the government intervention already that has helped create this. So before I get into the key components, Annette, your thoughts in AOC's bill here, which is in essence saying government needs to step in to solve this problem of housing. Your initial thoughts.
My initial thoughts is I can only imagine how we'll actually be living. No, it's as a mother who raised five daughters, and I sort of already said it with Tyler, is that when the government gets involved in things, I think the standards go down, and I think the living they will accept less and less for us, and ask us to accept less for ourselves, and that I find actually depressing because your home, yes, I get it. It's bricks and mortar, but think that's the place where you raise your family and create your memories. You cannot tell me that in terms of it's not a car. I know cars are really valued here in California, but to me, the home is, it represents so much more than just like the roof over your head. It's the place where you come together and eat and love each other. And it's a protection. It's all of these beautiful intangibles. And so I get troubled when government gets involved in that because I think they will accept far less for us than we would ever accept for ourselves in terms of what we want when we're creating our homes.
Well, it's funny you say that because you said it as in government wants us to accept less for ourselves, except the people implementing these laws and regulations have some of the most beautiful, biggest, most prestigious homes around.
Yeah, exactly.
So for Tyler and G, before I get your comments, let me talk about the key components of the Home Act. It establishes another federal housing development authority under the Department of Housing and Urban Development. It's set up for the creation and preservation of over a million affordable housing units. So it's not even for the middle class. This is directly geared towards supposedly helping the poor. And I say supposedly because we had the affordability acts, regulations, whatever you want to call them, various, and the poor still can't afford the homes, you know. This is a killer in terms of how economists probably look at her and they want to put a gun to their heads. Rent caps at 25% of a household's adjusted annual gross income. In other words, based on how much you earn, is going to determine how much you pay in rent. And correct me, Tyler and G, if I misread that. Provisions for both renters and potential home buyers. I read that as there's rules that are going to be in place for us. And it repeals the Fair Cloth Amendment to allow federal funding for new public housing. All that means is bigger national debt because money's going to be sunk into that. And it authorizes $30 billion in annual federal spending, funding through congressional spending and treasury-backed loans. So we're on the hook for anybody who defaults on a house. Tyler, these are the key components. What are your initial thoughts when you hear those key components? And then, G, your initial thoughts.
I think, G, my initial thoughts are this really was not written by an economist, or I don't know what classes she was going to. I guess she skipped micro or something. Micro.
That's a great answer. That's great. G, what's your initial thoughts on this?
Well, my thought is if you need – stay with me on this. If you need to go to the bathroom and you're in a park, the last place I want to go is a public restroom, right? And we've all been there, right? We would rather hop in our car and drive over to a Starbucks, which is somewhat better, but it's still a private restroom, right? It's taken care of. And I think that's what happens to public housing, these projects.
I like that analogy. It's not, the Starbucks restroom isn't perfect, but it's somewhat better.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Gotcha. No, that's a great comment, G. Let's get to our comment here by John T. Georgopoulos. Man, those Greeks and those long names, huh? You know, this is a true libertarian take. Let the market decide. Eliminate government-backed mortgages and eliminate most zoning restrictions. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Shouldn't ever try to legislate that. Now, John is partially right in my sense, because there are programs that are meant to help. Like, for example, if you're a veteran like I was, you served your country, you get government as a reward, kind of funds your down payment, you know, and that's for any eligible veteran. So there are some programs there, but for the most part, I would agree with Big John and letting the market decide, because you still, as a veteran, you still have to qualify for that home. All they do is kind of back the debt, they kind of make the down payment, but you still have to qualify based off the same criteria as anybody else. In AOC's issue, it's a little bit different. Her act, and this is what, and I apologize to Tyler G, I kind of bombarded you guys with 7 points here, and it was tough to remember. But the heart of this act is it wants to confront landlords' power to raise rents, meaning rent control. It wants to rethink public governance of housing markets beyond deregulation. Translation, they want government in the housing market. And they want government to be involved through price regulation. A couple of other points. But in essence, they want to confront landlords' power to raise rents. They want government in the housing market. And they want government to be able to be involved in price regulation. Annette, is this the greatest idea in the world or what?
As always, they think they know better. That's my problem with it. They think they know better, and they're just people like me and you. Once again, taking away my autonomy to make decisions for myself. I just think when the government steps in, we lose our autonomy each and every time, even if they think it's in the greater good. And actually, who said it? Oh, I can't think of his name right now. Who said that the worst oppression is from people who claim to trying to do the best for you?
Oh, God, yes. Yes, that's so true. I
know I said it not perfectly.
But it's tried and true. So, in essence, there are historical examples of where this has failed. You know, the rent control led to housing shortages or subprime mortgage policies that contributed to the 2008 financial crisis. So when you hear this, you look back at, hey, history has kind of shown this doesn't work. What are your thoughts? And then we'll go to Tyler. But real quick on Annette's point, God save us from do-gooders. Milton Friedman, a great economist. There you go. Gee, yeah.
Was it Ronald Reagan or someone earlier than him who said there's nothing more scary than a government official coming to your house and saying, I'm here to help?
Yeah. Run!
Yeah. I mean, I believe Santa Monica, we rented an apartment there for a year for my wife's employer rented an apartment for her. And they were rent controlled for a while, and then they realized it didn't work. And then I think they're back to rent controlling part of it. I mean, you know, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, right? And my wife also told me of a family member who started renting, I want to say, Uptown Manhattan, you know, up north of Central Park. I think their rent was $300 a month, and that person died. And then they just snuck someone else in there in the family, and now they're renting for $300 a month. And Uptown Manhattan, I mean, the market rent there's got to be $5,000 a month, but they're paying $300. So when you call the landlord and they're sitting there going, well, you know, to fix your toilet is going to cost me your whole month's rent, maybe 2 months. So, no, it's a terrible idea. AOC doesn't know what she's talking about. This just proves it. And, you know, am I wrong in saying her TikToks are enjoying, but that's about it.
So, Tyler, as somebody – that's a good one. So as somebody who's been on the Housing Commission, who is involved in politics, who has housing issues in where you want to serve, is there anything – the government can do, or should they just let it go and let the free market with minimal regulation? I say minimal because you can't let capitalism will turn quickly to crony capitalism and corrupt capitalism without, you know, at least a big brother looking over the shoulder to make sure you do things. But that doesn't mean we want big brother to actually get involved. Is there anything the government can do to help this situation out, or should they just stay away from it?
Well, if we want to localize this issue a little bit in the context of North County, let's take a look at Carlsbad. So you talk about building new housing. The vast majority of Carlsbad is already built out. Now, if you drive by the freeway, you'll see there's a lot of open space, right? That's set aside already. Natural reserve. It's, you know, there's a lot of riparian areas that per the state guidelines, you can't touch any of that. And so if you look at a zoning map like I have, I've studied from north to south, east to west, the zoning of the entire city. There's almost nowhere for you to build. So you really have to either go up and ruin the character of the city, or you need to go out. You need to go out to East County. You need to go out to other parts of North County. And so I think we need to learn from other states who have done this and created new housing for the middle class. You look at, why is California exporting all of its residents to Texas and Florida? Because they're building the housing out there that people want. Some people want to live in apartments, but most people want that American dream. They want to have a nice house with a garage and a yard. And why is our government, state, county, why are they putting the chains on the developers? That they say, well, you know, this county land out here, we really can't touch that at all because the squirrel, you know, we don't want to disturb its habitat. Well, I sympathize. I love nature, and I think this is one of the most beautiful places in the world. But you're pitting that against the needs of the entire middle class of the state of California. And yes, we want to preserve our nature. We want to have clean air and clean water. But we can't do that at the cost of the future of an entire generation. I think that is just unethical.
Right. No, I agree. I agree. And to the audience, so I'm sure some of you may not have found this the most exciting segment, but I think it's an important segment that we don't talk about enough. And I think part of the reason I also wanted to talk about it is we're in an era that it shocks me, but they're teaching our kids, you don't need a house. You don't want a house. You don't want that debt. It's all bad. And trust me, you grow up in a home, you don't ever want to live in an apartment and raise kids in an apartment. So the fact that we have programs that are going to literally destroy the ability to buy a home. And I say that because history has shown acts like what AOC wants to implement. She wants to feel good about herself by saying she's helping the poor, when in reality, government, as Ronald Reagan said, you know, if the government is here to help, you run. So thank you everybody for that segment. I want to move on right now to, let's see, Supreme Court justices. Here's hoping Garland finally takes security seriously, because clearly he thinks safety is just a suggestion. You know? So there was a recent threat to six members of the Supreme Court. You can pretty much guess for the six conservative members. An individual, Panos, where's Big John when you need him? Panos Anastasia. And God bless the elderly. He's 76 years old. I look at him, he must be a mountain man because he's from Alaska. He was arrested for threatening six Supreme Court justices and two family members. I was watching Fox News, and I rarely watch Fox News, but when I saw this, I flipped it on, and some of their sources were saying that it was the conservative members. He sent over 465 threatening messages. You would think after a few of them, you know, somebody at the FBI or DOJ would have gone, maybe we should check this guy out, because it is illegal to threaten people like that, you know, for the libertarians out there. Messages contain violent, racist, and homophobic language, including threats of assassination, torture, and lynching. This guy's really old school. Democrat old school KKK there with the lynching. He faces 22 counts, including 9 for threatening a federal judge and 13 for making interstate threats. I guess that's the one where you threatened them in your Alaska, that's crossing state lines. You know, he faces a maximum potential sentence of 155 years if convicted. At 76, I'm not sure he'll make 10 of those 155 if he gets convicted. So here's what I found. I don't know if irony is the best word here, but Attorney General Merrick Garland emphasized the importance of judges making decisions without fear. Do you think he would have followed his own advice to protect the justices after the Dobbs decision was leaked? And for those who may not remember, the Dobbs decision dealt with Roe versus Wade being overturned, mm-hmm. and he left the conservative justices unprotected during that whole span, and Kavanaugh actually had a death threat, and they arrested somebody. So you think he would have actually done something? So to me, this is just Merrick Garland just talking trash out of you know where. So because he refused to protect those judges. So my question to the group, and let's start with Tyler. The recent arrest for threats against SCOTUS judges highlights ongoing security concerns, and you can trace back to Trump's assassination attempts to the justices from the Dobbs decision. So Tyler, how can government balance protecting these officials with maintaining open access, meaning people do have the freedom to be able to say what they want, to express their First Amendment? Is that a possibility in this day and age with the rhetoric and the attempts we've seen? In fact, there's a great libertarian. He's not a great libertarian. There was a great case of standing up for your libertarian, for your liberty rights from a libertarian, and where the feds came to his house, had the video on them, and in essence told him to bleep off. He asked for ID. They refused to show ID. It got to the point where we were wondering, are those actual feds? But they ended up leaving. You know, and the catch 22 is, without a lawyer present, they're going to use everything you could say in a conversation, and they're going to distort it. So this guy was brilliant in how he was able to fend them off. But that said, is there a way that the government that we can have government balance in protecting public officials while maintaining open access for our own freedoms?
Well, I'd like to separate these two topics. You brought up one, keeping judges safe after they've received material threats of violence, and then you brought up the incident. I believe the name of the individual was Jeremy Kaufman, who is the New Hampshire libertarian who was ostensibly or apparently being questioned by FBI agents who went to his home. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what the video shows. So about the first topic. So we do have precedent in this country about what constitutes free speech and what constitutes a material, imminent bodily threat to an individual, whether they are just a citizen or someone who is a politician. And if an individual is making a real material bodily threat to someone, that does not constitute free speech. That is a direct threat of violence, and they should be followed up with by law enforcement. And so that is where we draw the line, and we need to have that protection in place for individuals in the community, as well as those in political office. Now, about the second topic with Jeremy Kaufman, and that's the viral video, right? Where he basically tells the FBI agents or whoever it is to bleep off. So I don't know the context of the tweets that Jeremy was making, but in the case where he was not stepping over that line, where he was not making immediate bodily threats of harm to a particular individual, then no. I don't think there's any room there to say, why is the FBI apparently questioning him? I think that is then violating his free speech rights. So I'd separate the two. I think there's a clear distinction. Again, you cross that threshold, you cross that Rubicon of making concrete, clear bodily threats, it's a different story. So that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it.
Okay, so before we get to Annette and G, Tyler's absolutely correct. I forgot Tyler has libertarian leanings. So that was right up your wheelhouse. I'm glad I went to you first, you know. So I want to show, he's right. Let's separate this out to the threats against judges and then our own freedoms, because this is a very important, this is where the libertarian in me comes out. Our freedom and our ability to say something. Because I've told you guys many times in previous podcasts, I don't know if Tyler's ever heard, I was in Panama once and I wasn't jacked up, but metaphorically I was jacked up by friends and family telling me to shut up because nothing was going to happen to me, the American citizen, and bad-mouthing Noriega, but they were afraid of their own lives and being taken away at night. So this is the video that we are referencing. Let me pop it up here. Okay.
How are you?
How are you?
I'm Agent O'Donnell with the FBI.
Can you give your full name, please?
I'm Agent O'Donnell with the FBI.
Is that sufficient to identify as only one O'Donnell affiliated with the FBI?
In New Hampshire, yes.
Could you please state your full name, sir?
Jeremy is brilliant here.
No. It's First Amendment right. Okay. What's your name, sir?
Could you start recording, please?
Absolutely not. You can show me your name and identification, or I'm going to go back inside my house.
I don't really
want to
broadcast my.
This is going out, right?
I apologize, people. Our producer reminded me the reason for this is in a post on X, he threatened Harris, VP Harris. He said something to the effect, somebody assassinated her, they'd be a hero or something. He didn't call for an assassination. He made a comment after the two Trump assassination attempts. So that's what supposedly drew them out. Am I correct on that, Tyler? Is that what you've been?
I am unaware of the context of the tweet.
Okay, well, that was a tweet, because the reason I say that, there were two tweets. Nobody knows specifically which one, but in essence, it was one of those types of tweets. So I may not agree with the tweet per se, but it's his right, you know, because he did not call for anybody to do that.
Right after you guys walk away.
So, that's why
so you can show me your name or ID. You can walk away.
Which one are talking
about? I'm not going to talk to people who claim to be federal agents unless they can show me identification.
You see our badges.
I need to see. Is your full name on that badge?
No.
I'd like to see something with your full name, or I'm not going to talk to you.
For you not to broadcast.
This will be going online as.
Right there, that's important, because every officer should identify themselves freely, and these two refuse to do so. That's my opinion.
As soon as you walk away.
Well, all I want to do is talk to you about a post that was made, and if you happen to be the one.
I want to talk to you about you guys coming here. Say you make a salary of, I don't know what, low 100K? You guys making six figures? Factor in 50% expenses, overhead, maybe 100% expenses. Talking about burning a couple $100 an hour just here, let alone all the time you guys are spending to investigate something that you know is not against the law, right? Like, you're familiar with. So then why would you come?
Because we wanted to make sure that there weren't any.
No, you're coming because you're part of a regime that does this kind of thing when you know laws aren't being broken. And that's an embarrassment, man. Didn't you guys read the Constitution? Do you not believe in America? Like, how do you do your jobs and go home?
We appreciate it.
You're walking away. Because nothing we did is against the law, and you guys are fuckheads that try to act like bullies. And I hope you go home.
All right. I'll stop it there only because I think Jeremy becomes an idiot at that point and sees he won the debate, the argument there, and he starts, you know, to call him names and things like that. And but this is important.
Jeremy starts to be an idiot there. No, I think Jeremy has been an idiot for a long time.
Yes, yes, he has.
That
yes,
doesn't mean what he did was against the law, but Jeremy has been an idiot for a long time.
He's the type of individual, guys, who pushes it to the limit. I have a philosophy. Don't be an idiot. Stand up for your rights. Don't be an idiot. Jeremy has a history of standing up for his rights but being an idiot. So technically, he's not breaking the law, but he's not really helping the cause. But in this case, you heard the guy says there was nothing illegal. And he's right. So why are you out here then? You know, they're out there, in my opinion, to intimidate. I saw this many times, not to myself, but to Panamanians in Panama with two dictators. So when I saw this, I was like, yeah, yeah, until he doesn't stop. And I'm like, dude, just shut up. You won, you know? But that is what Tyler was referring to. So when I was talking about the balance of us keeping our free speech right, that's exactly what I was talking about. Where is there a balance between that? But at the same time, your thoughts on the Supreme Court justices being threatened and a lack of protection that we saw in the Dobbs case in terms of what should be how should we deal with them to protect them at this point? You know, is it right to arrest a guy for making threats? He's all the way up in Alaska. He's 76. The odds of him carrying them out would seem to be slim to none. So what I'm trying to say is there any kind of balance we can find here? Gee, let's go with you, and then we'll go to Annette.
I mean, age doesn't matter to me. Whether you're 25 and, you know, ex-Marine or whatnot, or you're 76 and you live far away, if you make a threat, you make a threat. I mean, I'm really concerned about the current climate. It feels like we're entering back or have been back in like the climate of the 1960s where you had the JFK assassination, Martin Luther King, RFK. There was, I think it was a senator who said there's, or maybe Homeland Security, I can't remember, five open teams out there attempting to assassinate Trump. Right. I don't know what that means. I didn't read the whole context of that, but apparently, Ruth was the one we talked about was part of that. I don't understand how a guy who had no money, lives in Hawaii, flew out here, somehow obtained an AK-47 with the serial number scratched off. So, I mean, you know, the long word salad version of I'm really afraid that we're headed down a road where justices can be hurt or killed because of abortion, which, by the way, Ruth Bader Ginsburg also said it should be returned to the state. I mean, she expressed that opinion one way or another.
Hold on, G. What should be returned to the states? What was she talking about that should be
returned? I'm sorry, about abortion. The idea of abortion, right? So that's why these justices are being threatened, is because, you know, this whole return the decision back to the state, it was some kind of like sacred biblical text to the left that Roe versus Wade is codified and cannot be changed ever. And now we've broken some kind of sanctity rule. But no, it's just being returned back to the state. And California, as we all know, will always be a pro-choice state. So, you know, some people are unhinged out there, and if they can't get their way, I worry about these six justices. I mean, they go home, and what do they have? One guy sitting out front, right? And making sure that they're safe, right? Secret Service or whatnot. I don't know. I don't know the state of the Secret Service protection, but I just hope it's enough.
No, I understand. Annette, a few words on this, and then I want to go into what G opened up in terms of just the rhetoric. But what are your thoughts on protecting the justices and then our own free speech where you get feds rolling up and knocking on doors? And this sounds silly, but the conversations we have, we may one day say something and boom, there's a knock on our door because we're doing these podcasts. You never know. So your thoughts on those two?
No, I'll try to keep it really brief. I'll just first say about that guy that I hadn't seen that video before. And where the saying, like, you get more bees with honey. I mean, the point he was making was a good point, but then he loses it. He loses the win. No, by the way, he's acting because he was making a good point. And my question would be, if that same threat that he made or what he said, which really wasn't, was about Trump, would they show up at their door? I feel like they wouldn't. Do you know what I mean? I feel like it's not
exactly
equal.
Exactly.
It's not equal in terms of, but I think Tyler made the great point about these distinctions, threat to bodily harm versus saying like some of the terrible things we can all say that are protected under freedom of speech. But like these threats that you make, there is that line that they sometimes cross over. But with the justices, I would just say again, I mean, I would not, this is really hard for me, William, because I don't know what we're really doing with all of this. This to me is just what it's all about, the politics of they are more protective of the things that they believe in and less protective of the people they disagree with. That's what bothers me about it. That just seems so grossly obvious to me.
Correct. That's absolutely correct. And it's what you're trying to say is that Democrats are butthurt, but they fight back.
Not saying that again.
So G and Annette opened the door here.
That crosses your free speech line for the podcast. We can't say butthurt.
I don't know why the Simpsons and Bart Simpson came to mind with that term. So I wanted to lead this up to the rhetoric. You know, I'm sick and tired of the rhetoric needs to calm down on both sides. I'm like, both sides? What are you talking about, both sides? 2017, the congressional baseball shooting because of a Bernie Sanders supporter. You know, then we had the two assassination attempts to Trump. And that was, to me, because over the years, the Democratic mainstream media rhetoric, the Charlottesville very fine people comment that has been debunked. It should have been debunked from day one, but the Democrats and the mainstream media pushed that. The claims of Trump being a threat to democracy. When you tell somebody being a threat to democracy, they think, oh my God, he's going to end the way we live, the way our lives are. And that's a central campaign tactic by both Democrats and the media. And this is what people, if you haven't figured this out, America, then pull your head out of the sand, because there are people who can't process words from reality, meaning these, and I see, to your point, Annette, I'll take it one step further. I think deep down the Democrats and the mainstream media are okay if an unhinged person takes out a Supreme Court justice, because then all of a sudden Biden can appoint a Democrat. Or if they take Trump out, then who's going to be facing Kamala in November? I think deep down there are certain components of those sides that actually want this to happen, because there's no way you can sit there and keep talking about the very fine people comment and believe that that's what he actually meant. It's been debunked over and over. So people keep repeating that lie. They're repeating it for a reason, and that's to gin up violence, in my take. The threat to democracy, the comparisons to Hitler, and that he's a fascist, the mischaracterizations of Trump's policies. He wants a national abortion ban. He's never said that. He'll get us into World War III. Remember that? From 2016 to 2020, or before that for the election? The invasions and terrorist attacks, who had they happened under? Democrat, Obama and Biden and / Kamala regimes. He's a Putin pawn. Now, I say this with a grain of salt. Maybe I'm getting into the rhetoric myself, but who did Putin endorse? Kamala, you know, and the Israel and Hamas battles that happened after Trump left office, the Ukraine invasion after Trump left office, Biden, and they don't learn, and then they make every lie up. Well, Biden sits there and said, well, you know, putting Trump in a bullseye. Oh, you're all taking my words in context. No, you said put him in a bullseye, you know, and then this is the one that's atrocious. And again, I apologize beforehand. He's a silver spoon bum who's never worked a day in his life, and he should be grateful that in the 1800s, his ancestors made the denim jeans. And that is Dan Goldman, who said Trump should be eliminated, and eliminated as in taken out. You know, then he went on and made a post that, oh, no, I didn't really mean it that way. And then AOC lying by stating Trump runs concentration camps towards illegals, when it was her boy Obama who was the one that separated the parents from the kids. You know, and even then, that was not a bad move by Obama, because they weren't doing DNA testing. Those could have been traffickers with those kids. We didn't know. So all this hate, all this rhetoric, G and Annette kind of alluded to that. I'll get to you two in a second. Tyler, I kind of went on a rant, because it's not that it's personal to me. It's I've seen this firsthand with two dictators. And people who sit there and say, oh, it's just worse, or they lie. The rhetoric on both sides needs to come out. No, it's from one side. What can be done to lower the temperature? And I'll take a gun to my head if you say both sides need to slow down with the rhetoric. You know, what can be done? What should be done? I mean, I am loath to make laws against this, but unless something is done to these people who keep saying this over and over, I don't see this changing. Please tell me I'm wrong. I mean, is there any way that we can bring down this rhetoric from the left?
Well, I think we're in a particular point in history where we are. History doesn't repeat, it rhymes, and we are rhyming with the 1960s. We are rhyming because there were actual assassinations in the 60s, including a president. So it's an unfortunate place that we're at. Now, my hope would be is that as a country, we're going to move through this and we're going to get through November and no one's going to die, hopefully. I'm really crossing my fingers here, and that after the election is over, and hopefully that's a big question mark, and I'm running my own campaign, and I'm trying not to lose sleep at night about November because we don't know what's going to happen. Are we still going to have a country after November? I don't know. There are a lot of scary contingencies for you to go down a rabbit hole, but I'm going to try and stick to the facts and stick to where we are right now. And I think that we need to reflect on the heightened emotional state that we're at right now. And we need to remember that we're all Americans here and that we didn't break away from the British to have a country where people are murdering each other in the streets because we have political differences. So I am going to take the tack that, but both sides need to calm down, and you can hate me for that. So I'll let you hate me for that.
Okay. So let me add this to you, too, since you guys opened the door with the previous discussion. It was the Democrat Party working with the media that purposely created election interference by hiding the Hunter Biden laptop. That would have changed people's minds. It was the Democrat regime that forced the social media companies to censor conservatives. It seems like it is Kamala who has sat there and said that Elon Musk, I can't remember how she said it, but kind of lost his right to free speech because of what he allows to be posted on X. So it seems to me like it's the Democrats who are projecting here. Because I'll be honest, conservatives always watch what they say because they don't have the media on their side. The moment they say anything even slightly negative in that manner, they get castrated. So your take on the rhetoric. Is it just from one side, G, or is it coming from both sides?
Predominantly, it's coming from the left. That's what I see. And when you think about these assassinations in the 1960s, I mean, both parties were closer to the center at that point, right? I mean, we had a lot more in common, we have a lot more in common than we have differences when she tries to go on her word salad attempt at inspiration. But we were a lot closer together. And those three figures got assassinated, right? But we're more polarized than ever. I would argue now the Republican Party is more center right, closer to the center, Trump's not so ideological. And the left is getting more and more ideologically tilted that way. And they view things as a religious crusade. And, you know, we've all been to the Central Committee of the Republican Party. There's always a prayer, right? Lincoln Reagan dinner, we have a prayer. Democrat Party, they don't have prayers. And going back to the Republicans, it's not that everyone's a Christian there. But just out of respect for a higher power, we pray. But the Democrat Party, I would say most of them that are active, I'm not saying all Democrats, but most of the ones who are active and go to the party meetings, that is their church. That is their religion. And I think it becomes more and more of a religious fervor of belief that would lead them to take drastic action. You know, people take for their own religion, the extremists at least. So, I think that's, it is mostly coming from the left.
Yeah, and it's funny when G brings up the science, we're going to watch a skit here, an AI skit, and at the end, somebody goes, instead of saying God bless America, science bless America. And even then, it's only when the science helps them. You don't see Democrats talking science anymore when it comes to abortion. You know, before it was like, gotta follow the science, because they knew the science couldn't tell when the heartbeat started or when a baby was actually conceived. Now that we can scientifically show that, you know, even their belief in science is a pseudoscience. But your take on, is the rhetoric coming just from one side? I mean, I'll be honest. You know, some people would claim Trump, it was rhetoric with Trump saying, lock her up, you know. To me, I was like, yeah, lock her up, you know. It wasn't calling for her death, but they were saying, that's rhetoric. If that's what they call rhetoric on the right that we need to clamp down, then I'm like, then we're lost, because that's, to me, it's not rhetoric. Where's the rhetoric coming from? Both sides, one side, how do you see this?
Well, can I comment to what Tyler and G said too really quickly? Because I thought they both made such great points. They did, Tyler. You're great. you make such really coherent points.
We're just too agreeable for you, William. You're going to have to bring on someone who's just going to poke us.
But, G, what you said about religion and beginning with a prayer, it's in the Bible. And no one has to believe in the Bible. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying in Paul's epistles, he makes a really good point about when we stop believing in a higher power, something greater than ourselves, let's just put it that way, that, and you start only worshiping yourself, eventually you're worshiping the dirt. Sadly, I think, and he says it in a lot better way, and I have to find the passage that I'm not remembering exactly, but I think that is sort of where we're at. Now, I would love to say my automatic response, William, was, you know, model the behavior that you'd like to see. Because I've always believed that that could sort of work, because then it's like you're raising the bar. You know, you're not going to stoop to that. You're going to be respectful. You're going to really listen. And I try to do that in my own politics. But what I see happening sometimes is when you take that tick, you know, then you like, you give an inch, you give another inch, you give another inch, and they do take that. And all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, I just gave up. You know, I gave up everything. It's like sometimes I feel like that approach in this environment is not really working. So I guess I would put it out there to our listeners, and I hope we have a lot of them, and back to G and Tyler and you, William, like, what do we do about that? Because I don't think that coming back, you know, venom with venom, fighting fire with fire, where are we going with that? I mean, I do not see that healing our divided nation. We've got to transcend this somehow. I don't know who it's going to be. I don't know how we're going to do it, but I just think it's such a really, we're hitting upon a real problem, and I'm not sure that I have the great answer for it, but I put it out there to all of you guys who are smarter than me.
You know, it's as somebody who does great monologues, I use my intellect here. No, I think it comes down to schools. We have to take the schools back. We have to put teaching back in the schools. We have to teach kids to critically think. You get these morons out there because they don't critically think. They don't sit there and pause and stop and understand what's being said versus the actual actions. It's like, who's projecting? The actions have shown it's Democrats who are promoting. It's all these assassination attempts going back to the soccer field. It's the Democrat side, and it is one side. And it's incumbent on Republicans to figure out, okay, why is this happening? It's happening because we've become such a dumb nation. And I'm not saying that off opinion. You look at the data with the graduation rates, where they're graduating at, their reading and writing abilities, but most importantly, the lack of an ability to critically think. If people would stop and just critically think, Dan Goldman said eliminate him. Oh, that's pretty harsh, Dan. You know, we need to have a talk, Dan. And the talk being, you maybe go support a different candidate. But instead, we don't. We fall in love with AOC. We believe the lies of the media. And we have our own versions on the Republican side. You know, I pull my head out of Kentuckians and go, are you guys dumb? I mean, you guys keep sending Mitch McConnell back. You know, it's like Mitch McConnell doesn't care about you. He's married to a family that comes from a billionaire family. You know, it's like it's a caste system is what I'm trying to say. So it's incumbent on the Republicans getting our schools to teach again. You know, it's and having law and order. I know that it's the libertarian side of me is this is where I battle it out, because I'm like, yeah, we have to have law and order. That's what makes America great. Every country where 90% of the immigrants that come here, what, we're fleeing a lack of law and order. You know, those feds that Jeremy was crapping on. Okay, maybe in that case, but he always goes too far. But at the end of the day, if somebody's beating on you and your wife in the city, you're going to be looking for a cop somewhere. And let me remind people out there, cops, would they run 99% of cops do not ever brandish their weapon. You know, they do their jobs and do it properly. And most cops who do brandish a weapon or hear a gunshot, they run to the where they hear it, because they do want to help out. You know, I'm a big Cold Case Files fan, 48 Hours, that these are cops that they give their lives to go help people, to go solve these crimes, you know. So we also have this negative connotation of cops. What we do is we amplify the bad cops into becoming the norm, and that's also on us, and that's also public education. You know, remember when we were kids, the cops would come talk about being a cop, things like that. So we just kind of completely lost our way, and to me it starts with education. That's what separated America. We used to produce the brightest minds in the world. Now we have to import them. You know, from around the world, because we don't have enough smart kids to fill these tech jobs. So that's where I think it all begins and it all ends, quite frankly, because an educated mind is a mind that will question and will keep this country from getting to this point again. Anyway, that is my rant on it. I truly believe in my heart that I am right in that sense. And I'm not saying I'm right because it's my opinion. I'm saying you educate the person and they formulate their own opinion. In my heart, 90% of the time, they will formulate the correct opinion. And that is to always question. And to
come to our solution. Go ahead. We're failing there, William. We're failing there. That's correct. We're not teaching kids how to think for themselves, how to critically think. You're absolutely right. And you were failing in that area. I agree with that.
Yeah, if only we had competent people on school boards.
Yeah, they need to all be removed.
I will take a bit of a contrarian position about the FBI agents visiting Jeremy. They had every right to, right? They could see something online and go, okay, we just need to go check that out, right? And they did their job perfectly. They knocked on the door. They asked if they could ask some questions, and he said no. And they're like, all right, we're out of here. Right. And so there's nothing preventing them from going to investigate something. Right. Now, if they said, no, we need to go in your house, we need to take your computer, we need to take your phone, that would have been crossing the line. So
I will push back on your pushback. and
I like this. Finally, we're getting something.
It's intimidating when a federal officer or just a cop, because they are figures of authority, and we're taught to respect it, and they count on that. So you had a Jeremy there who'd said and he did the right thing by asking for ID. You know, and when they refuse to show their ID, I'm like, no, now you're in the wrong. You're not willing to identify yourself. And anybody can have a fake gun that looks real in your holster and have a fake badge. So he was asking them to show their ID. Now, somebody brought up a good point. Maybe these cops are undercover, meaning they're not going to show their ID, and their ID that they have is a real ID, but they have a street name or something. So whatever reason, doesn't matter. It's a two-way street. We pay their salaries. We also expect a form of decorum from them to us. And the moment they fail to show it is the moment they
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. And they could have caught him up.
Right. I was talking strictly about them visiting. Now, they refused to really show their ID. I don't understand why, but yes, they were in the wrong with that. But then they backed off, right? And they said, all right, we're out of here. So I watched this YouTube channel called Impact Media, IINOA. Is that right? Yeah. IINOA. So IIMPCT Media. And what they do is they go out, they're masked, and they videotape people in public. And people flip out on them. And it's amazing because, one, they're wearing masks, and two, they're recording them. And their point is, well, just 3 years ago, everyone had to wear masks. And you were probably one of them who enforced it, right, by telling people, wear your mask. And two, you're being recorded by everyone, right? And it's when the law enforcement comes up, they know how to deal with the law enforcement. And the law enforcement's also tipped off to them, and law enforcement doesn't really get into their grill for the most part, and they don't want to because they're on camera and they're going to be all over YouTube. But they know that they can't do anything about it. They're recording in public. They're not on private property. So, you know, as long as, and to push back on your pushback, on my pushback, as long as the education's out there that you have rights against law enforcement, if they're not acting within their bounds, you have more bounds than they do. So we just need better education, like you said.
Exactly.
It's not the school's place to do that, but it needs to be
done. Well, I think it's a combination because we are now dual income society. So I think it's a combination of the schools and parents working together to raise the best child, meaning the school's in charge of the education, the parent should be in charge of the social side. And that includes the school. Hey, you need to talk to your kid about this, this, and this. What's happened is the schools have decided to talk to the kid about this, this, and this, and they crossed that line where a good teacher would talk to the parent, hey, you know, you should have the talk with your kids. And Tyler, real quick, I was making a joke because Annette and G serve on the Rancho Santa Fe School Board. Yeah, so that's why I made that comment there. All right, let us move on to death by pagers. When your communication device doubles as a bomb, maybe it's time to switch providers. You know, and obviously I'm talking about the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah. It's Israel going on the offensive to take out Hezbollah, key Hezbollah figures to try to kind of cower, put the fear of God or Allah, however you want to call it, into Hezbollah to stop these terrorist attacks. So supposedly Israel tampered with pagers. Well, not supposedly, the word on the street, I guess, is that Israel tampered with pagers used by Hezbollah operatives, and they're causing explosions, and these targets have been carried out with individuals in Lebanon and Syria. And the attacks has resulted in 9 to 12 deaths. Some reports I saw 9 that were early on, others I saw 12. And it includes Hezbollah members and possibly children, with over 2,800 people injured. And again, an example, I'm not going to show the image, but this is causing devastating damage. So for example, one person that did not die, half his thigh was gone. It was literally like a shark attack, so these are causing terrible damage. And I'm not going to show the videos, I had them queued up, but you know, they're pretty violent. In essence, what happens, they hear the beep beep beep, oh, I got a message, then boom, you know. And it doesn't necessarily kill them, but it takes out a good, it does massive trauma. And this is war. This is why I tell people war is an absolute last resort. But when you go to war, there is no kindness in war. You go to war to destroy the enemy, period, end of story. Because when war is not resolved and compromise is found, that's flaw compromise. It's fake compromise. Because eventually the one side that initiated the issue in the first place will go back, regroup, and come back and do it again. History has shown that. So what makes this one also unique is that Iranian ambassador to Lebanon was among those injured and not killed in the attack. And we've been hearing nothing but Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. This dealt with Hezbollah. They are two different groups. Hamas focuses, founded in 1987, it focuses on the Palestinian issue, aiming for the establishment of a Palestinian state. Hezbollah was founded in 1982. It's a Shia resistance movement focused on expelling Western powers from the Middle East. Now, both of these have one thing in common: the eradication of every Jew in the Middle East, the eradication of Israel as a nation. There's a reason people forget, and then it's not taught anymore. Clinton had a two-state solution. He presented it to Yasser Arafat. Arafat realized, oh my God, if I agree to this, I'm going to be dead tomorrow, because they don't want a two-state solution. They want the eradication of Israel. So he said, no, I'll take my billions and go home. Billions from our taxpayers' dollars. So to set that up, my first question to you three as a group, we'll start with Tyler. What was the Iranian ambassador from Iran doing with a pager? Tyler. I can't hear you, Tyler.
Sorry about that. I thought I was going to get a good setup to make a joke about, you've got mail. but I didn't get it.
Where's your compassion, son? Where's your compassion?
Yeah. Well, I can't imagine what that have been like. We are entering now in the 21st century a very scary phase of asymmetric warfare, and the capabilities of technology and the digital transformation of warfare are just beginning to show what the future holds, and I think it's a very frightening thing.
I agree. I agree. That was Tyler is on his way to becoming a great politician. Is a great dodge there. Gee, what was the ambassador to Lebanon from Iran doing with the pagers?
Well, obviously, the reason why they have pagers is because they didn't want to be tracked by these, right? So they figured Israel had a way to track them with these. Well, that's the Iranian people too. It's a proxy war, right? So Iran is at war with Israel, just not directly. They're doing it through these militants. So that's why. I mean, that's why he has the pagers and they're all comedic. What's interesting to me is they didn't get these pagers out in the last 10 months. I mean, they must have been having these pagers with the little explosives on their hips for several years, right? And they're just waiting because this is a one-shot deal.
Yes.
You do it once, right? And then the element of surprise is gone. So they're waiting for a time when they needed to do it, and it was after Hezbollah started launching rockets in, what, last month or 2 months ago, something like that? Actually, I think it was early August, same time as the yen carry trade unwind. But, yeah, so they said, okay, well, this is, we're going to do this now. And, I didn't realize it was that few deaths, 9 to 12. I mean, is this going to be effective? Well, now you got these two-eyed terrorists, now one-eyed terrorists, right? And they're angrier than ever. So I don't know. I'm pro-Israel, but I don't know how this is going to make things better. It's going to probably spiral out of control.
Okay, so Annette, before you answer, and I apologize to the audience, let me tell you a little bit about the Iranian ambassador to Lebanon. I think it's Motaba Amani. He's the Iranian ambassador to Lebanon. He was injured, obviously, in the pager explosions, we've stated. He reportedly lost an eye. So, you know, this is, you know, as John says, his new motto, instead of from the river to the sea, John's motto for Hezbollah is now from the liver to the knee. You know, but this one went to the eye, injury of the eye. So his role is beyond diplomatic duties. He was appointed in 2022 by the former Iranian foreign minister who viewed foreign policy as an extension of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And that's an arm of Iran that specializes in terrorism and things of that nature. And traditionally, Iranian ambassadors to Lebanon are often appointed from the Revolutionary Guard to facilitate connections amongst the various militant groups. So in essence, this ambassador's role, part of his unspoken role, is you are the go-between from the motherland, Iran, to these actual terrorist groups. And this guy's been present at meetings between the Iranian officials and Hezbollah leadership. So, we kind of know why he was targeted. As G alluded to, this was not just hey, let's go ahead and do this. This was deep planning. This is Israel going on the offensive. What are your thoughts on Israel going on the offensive here? And let me move forward to the second part, is the ethics that our side, that Westerners seem to scream about. You know, you're harming the children, ignoring the fact that Hezbollah and Hamas and all these terrorist groups use civilians to hide behind, and in my opinion, to create this propaganda. See, they're killing civilians. So, but that is an issue that we don't seem to want to let go on our side. So what are your thoughts on, one, Israel taking the time to plan this out? I mean, we don't know how long it took, but this is not an overnight thing. And how does Israel combat the fact that they're using the civilian casualties as propaganda?
Okay, well, I'm super interested in this issue, and I think it's and terribly sad. That's not even to go all the way. I mean, obviously they were clever and patient, and they had planned this for a long time, like G said. And then it was just the time when they were going to actually implement it. From what I read and from talking to someone I know who lives in Israel, they had to have had been this technology or these pagers. They knew what they were going to do. They had to get a hold of it, somehow infiltrate it, and make sure that they had the detonation was going to be possible for this later time when they were going to do it. So it was a very planned thing. Like, it could have taken, I don't know how long it was planned for, obviously, at all. But when I was reading about it, what it made me think about was two things. One was that movie, and I really hope you guys saw it because it would be so much better, but maybe our listening audience saw it, called Munich by Steven Spielberg.
Yes, yes, yes.
You remember the scene when he's talking to the guy, and they're in like in the concrete, maybe stairwell, both having a cigarette. They don't know who each other are. The one guy doesn't realize he's Israeli, for sure, but he knows that the other guy is definitely an Arab, let's say. So he basically, they start getting into an argument. You realize it's never, ever, they can, it's that it's not going to work, which made me think about the other book that I read many years ago by Will Galen, who's a bioethicist, called Hatred. And it really wasn't about this conflict in the Middle East, but it was about the deep seeds of hatred, which you see in this movie, these two men who don't really know that they're on opposite, opposing sides. That the hatred they have for one another and for that other group of people is so deep. It's so entrenched in who they are. They cannot coexist. I don't see how they're going to be able to coexist unless, I don't know, you guys. I mean, I was always really moved by that part of the film because I thought it was true and I thought it was accurate and I thought it didn't depict some sort of flowery way that these two people are going to have a kumbaya moment. Because they're just not going to. Because the guy says, we will wait. We will be patient. And if it's not us, it's going to be our next generation. Because then they're going to come for you. I mean, it's just, they seem to talk about indoctrination. I mean, that's really literally what they're saying. They are training. No, right? It's a part of it.
No, you're absolutely right. And before Tyler, I get your thoughts on this. I want to interject that.
Yes.
I think you're absolutely right. There was a video going around from this Jew who went there. He said he was Italian, you know, asking them about the two-state solution, what they should do. Every single, not to a T, every individual was like, no, we got to kill every Jew, eradicate them. They're scum, they're pigs. I saw about 30 years ago, at 60 Minutes, I'm older, you know, in my mid-50s, about 30 years ago, maybe even longer, I saw the indoctrination of like a four-year-old girl when they asked her about Jews. And she would have made a sailor proud. The way this little four-year-old went off. That's, and on a side note, that's why I got involved in politics on the identity politics side, because we are indoctrinating minorities to hate white Americans. You know, it's hate. Hate begets hate. So you're actually right. There is never going to be a kumbaya moment, in my opinion, because when you indoctrinate with hate, it begets hate. So Israel's like, Israel now looks at it as like, we got to protect ourselves at all costs. I think Israel has not crossed any lines. I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is Israel, I think with this incident that happened October 7th, and they see how the world is against them in many aspects, they're saying it's us against the world. And I think that's what helped escalate this, because they see, why is Iran doing this? How is Iran capable of doing this? Easy. With Obama sending them billions and then Biden sending them hundreds of billions also. They have the money to fund these terrorists. We are as complicit in all of this as Democrats who accuse Israel of being complicit in these deaths. We are just as complicit because we are funding the terrorists through lies. We do the same thing with Planned Parenthood. When we give them money, oh, they're not using that money for abortions. Well, yeah, they are. They're just on paper able to separate it and make it look kosher. Hey, I like the way I threw kosher in there. Trying to make it kosher and nice and pretty on paper. But the reality is the money that we give Planned Parenthood, they're able to use their other money to advertise, promote abortion. It's the same thing with Iran. They're able to use all this excess money now and use it on their terrorist groups. That's my take to enhance what you said in terms of hate begets hate. And there is not going to be a kumbaya moment. Now, Tyler, as a politician or future politician here, We are a copycat world. It doesn't matter if it's sports and offensive, defensive schemes, business plans, you know, we are a copycat world. Somebody's saying, hey, this pager idea works pretty good. I mean, they can easily transport it to phones. What are your thoughts of this?
That's why it's so scary.
And coming here. Yes.
In a matter of a few seconds, the Israeli intelligence forces were able to transmit some sort of detonation signal to how many thousands of phones spread across the entire Middle East and almost nearly simultaneously detonate a device in the pockets of specific targets. It's a truly terrifying capability. And the thought of other governments copycatting that is a world which I think, unfortunately, we are entering. So that's the next stage of warfare. So
I agree. I
have to say that when I found out about it that morning, I looked at my iPhone 14, made in China. Right?
Yeah, we don't make them. We don't make them. Who knows what the supply chain is?
Some CCP guy gets in there and says, this is what I want you guys to do. Right? And then how's Tim Cook going to know about it? I mean, he's not sitting there having his guys inspect every iPhone. So just it is scary.
Right. Okay. And then I'll give you the last word on this, and then we shall move on.
I mean, how do we move on from a subject like this? Because I think it should all cause us a great deal of pause, because we'll look at the world that we're living in. This is not what, I mean, I know I'm not one of those who believes, I know there's been fighting since man came on this earth, and that's always been something that's troubled me. But I guess when I think about this particular issue between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and I know some people were rejoicing about what a good and smart, you know, tactic that was, and they were really proud of it. And I know that's part of warfare. Part of that is winning. And they felt like that was a winning moment for them and a victory for them. But all of that, for me as a human being on this planet, it makes me extremely sad, William. That's how I feel about it. I honestly just feel sad. And I don't see how that situation gets any better. I really don't.
Well, that image that I'm just showing, supposedly 32 terrorist leaders taken out by Israel. When I say taken out, I guess taken out can be taken at however you want to look at it, meaning they've been removed from the battlefield in some form or fashion. And the reason I show that is, if that's true, it shows this is successful. And anything that's successful, no matter the carnage, it will happen again. And I have seen, I don't know if you guys have seen some of the videos, but it's devastating. It's like a little cartoon, meaning, you know, we're so accustomed to the movies, boom, boom, you know, all these massive explosions. These are simple pop, but the damage it does, you know, and these are men. It's damage is right in the midst for even a woman. You know, but there's the male machismo ego, you know, that's your private parts, you know, a lot, especially in that type of society. It's that's even more devastating, to them to have, to be taken out that way. So I don't think we're going to see the end of this. I think Israel has decided they are going to put the fear of God into their enemy, and yeah. Damn what the U.S. says. Damn. In fact, they worked with the UK on this or in some kind of information transfer back and forth. It was the UK, not the United States. Why? It was the Obama regime and the Biden-Harris regime that has been friendly with Iran. So they probably see us as an enemy in certain ways. And let me remind America about this. Israel, whether you like them or not, is the only democratically elected regime in the Middle East. They are the only regime in the Middle East that does not carry out terrorist attacks or support it or allow it to happen by using their state for nefarious action. So as much as you may want to hate Israel in certain cases, don't forget that, because they're the ones who were attacked. And I said we had the last words, but I kind of carried on.
Not trying to get the last word, but I was just reading something about Israel today. It was an interesting fact that I found to be very interesting. You know, they're considered, Israel and actually Singapore, considered like the most honest brokers in our world. in terms of being more ethical and honest in relationships like foreign affairs, et cetera. They had a whole list of nations that were really dishonest, but they were considered the most honest in terms of how well they play with others. I thought that was very interesting.
I'll say this about Singapore. They are black and white with their laws. You mess up with their laws, you will pay the price, period, end of story. I've been through Singapore.
I hope you don't want to chew gum when you go to Singapore.
You better swallow that gum when it's done. When that bubble gum is done, 2 seconds after you chew it, you better swallow
it. That happened 25 years ago, and we still remember it, right? I mean,
Well, if you're thinking about the kid he whipped, he actually spray painted.
Definitely. I was going to say, I thought he was keying cars or something.
Yeah, he was keying cars in the face. But gee, the bubble gum is the example that they give, like in the military. When I was in the military, it's the example they always give out. You chew bubble gum, you spit it out on the street, or you spit on the sidewalk, you're done. You're done, you know? Anyway, so let's move on here. We are going to move on to our final topic of the night, Newsom's tyrannical punchline, where free speech dies and government-approved comedy reigns supreme. So what I am referring to is Assembly Bill 2355 and Assembly Bill 2839. And before y'all go, what the hell is he talking about? I'm going to tell you. Assembly Bill 2355 requires disclosure that a political advertisement was generated or substantially altered using artificial intelligence. In our world of compromise, where compromise is how we live and we move forward, fair enough. I get it, because AI makes some devastatingly real videos now. Assembly Bill 2839 prohibits the creation and dissemination of deceptive AI-generated content about candidates and election officials within specific timeframes around elections. That's the one literally every American has or should have a problem with, because we're talking our First Amendment and our 14th Amendment rights. So in essence, I don't care about the first one, but he signed them both the same day. They seem to be tied in together. I don't know why, but we'll start with you, Ms. Annette. Assembly Bill 2839 prohibits the creation and dissemination of AI-generated content about candidates around election times. When you hear that, the government saying, no, you can't do that, Annette. It's not illegal, but we're making it illegal, but you can't do that. What's your thought?
What are they making illegal, William? Exactly.
Creating AI-generated content. So let me show you with an example here.
Oh. Yes, I would like an example so I can comment appropriately.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough, Ms. Annette.
All right. Thank you.
Governor of California. This is a message for the people of America, given in my authentically recorded non-AI voice. Thanks to my leadership over the last several years.
For the audience, it is an inauthentic Gavin Newsom voice. It is an AI generated. I'm trying to conform with Assembly Bill 2355 by disclosing it.
Don't give him the powers. Come on.
California has become a world leader in extremist left-wing governance. My policies were so effective that almost 1 million people are now fleeing the state every year. We even ran out of U-Hauls. During the COVID pandemic, I locked everyone in their homes and shut down businesses for months. Not the French Laundry, though. That's my favorite restaurant. I cleaned up the dangerous, messy streets of San Francisco, you know, because Chinese Communist President Xi was coming, and I really wanted to impress him. He's my boss, after all. This year, I signed legislation that allows me to take custody of your kid if you refuse to give him artificial hormones and chop off his genitals. Because if you don't do that, you're a bigot. And bigots should...
Okay, I'm stopping it. I'm going to keep going, but I'm stopping it partially because our producer says you need to make comments here so we don't get copyright hit. But I also want to give... this is a video is from the Babylon Bee, one of America's greatest satirical sites. We shall continue.
Shouldn't be allowed to have kids. I've also led the way in green energy by banning all cars that don't run on electricity. Then I banned almost all the electricity. This is smart leadership. On my watch, the cost of living and homelessness have skyrocketed. Schools are failing. Drug dealers and human traffickers are pouring across the border. And poop has covered the sidewalks of San Francisco. This is the positive, joyful vision we offer as Democrats.
Okay, I'm going to continue. I want everybody to see all of it. But real quick, Tyler, then Annette, then G. Watching this, you realize it's a satire, right? Is there any way you would think otherwise, Tyler? Simply a yes or no here.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious it's satire. And if you thought this was not satire, well, you'd have bigger issues.
G.
No, I mean, obviously it's satire, but I would not have known just by listening to his voice alone, right? If this was a more serious video and with a little points of sarcasm here and there, I would have thought it really was him.
Gotcha. Okay. And Ms. Annette has left us. I guess we did not capture her interest. Or, I'm sorry, Newsom ran her off. We shall continue.
That's why I'm enthusiastically endorsing Kamala Harris for president in 2024. She'll do to the country everything I did in California. Anyway, I'm California Governor Gavin Newsom, and I approve this 100% real message, which is a recording of my voice without the assistance of any AI whatsoever. This isn't a deep fake, and you can rest assured that it isn't, because I just signed an unconstitutional law outlawing deep fakes. No one would dare violate it. Thank you, and science bless America. Hi, I'm Gavin Newsom.
Oh, my goodness. I got to be honest, guys. That was pretty original. Very well done. It's obvious it's satire. I get G's voice. If you're like working in the yard or just talking to somebody and you hear it, you're not listening, but you're just assuming, oh, Gavin Newsom's droning on about something again, you know? Yep. So supposedly, see, this is what he wants to protect. And I think he wants to protect this because I'm not going to say there's more creativity with conservatives or anything like that, but I think they don't want the satire to be Kamala. There's one about Kamala, and I didn't key that one up, but it's great on her and her word salads. You know, in fact, the whole ad, the whole satire parody is her doing another word salad. And you really don't need satire for that. You can just post one of her own real word salads up there, you know? So there, an immediate legal challenge came from this. So, Ms. Annette, real quick, could you tell that was satire or not?
Yes, there I can tell. Okay. Without a doubt.
We're all in agreement, satire. Okay,
so there was,
yes, legal challenge. The lawsuit was filed by Christopher Coles. God bless Christopher Coles. Where he challenges the law claiming they violate free speech rights under the First and 14th Amendments. And real quick, this was his big shtick here. Let me show this image here. Okay, so this is where he says, I just signed a bill to make this illegal in the state of California. You can no longer knowingly distribute an ad or other election communications that contain materially deceptive content, including deep fakes. And this is what he accused of. This is why he pushed it. Elon Musk a couple of weeks ago, and he said it was a fake, you know, and that pissed Gavin Newsom off. Now, I'm sure this law was already in the books, but kind of helped push him forward and bring it up to the forefront. Correct me, guys, if I'm wrong. I'm doing a little logical speculation here. But I think part of the problem Newsom saw is Elon Musk and his 180 million followers, you know, distributing this out would not help any of his preferred candidates. And I think that's one reason we saw this law kind of fast-tracked, if it was fast-tracked, but it's in place now before the election. So real quick for the audience, the First Amendment protects freedom of speech, religion, press, and assembly. So when I saw that, I'm like, okay, how does this relate to the First Amendment? And lawyers can help decipher that, but it does. But the one that I did understand with no issues is the 14th Amendment, which ensures equal protection under the law and extends many constitutional rights to the state level, including First Amendment. And what that means is this law is overly broad, it's vague, and it can violate the equal protection by treating different types of speech or speakers differently, which goes back, Annette, indirectly, but goes back to your rhetoric, where it seems like the rhetoric is coming from one side, you know, and when they go and check up on it, it's always checking up that it prefers one side, meaning they're not giving both sides equal treatment. That's what I get out of the 14th Amendment here, in terms of one of the potential dangers with this. Tyler, your thoughts on the First Amendment and 14th Amendment, and none of us are lawyers, but we all honor and respect the Constitution. My first thought was First Amendment for sure, but what are your thoughts on this in Newsom's law violating our First and 14th Amendment? Plus, you got to know this. Like, you are an up-and-coming politician.
Violating First Amendment. So the thing that came to my mind is we have protections in speech, and this applies to art. So when you put out art, whether that is something that you painted or something that you've written or filmed, that is under the auspice of free speech. Now, one could make the argument that these videos are a form of art. For example, the Babylon Bee, that was a piece of satire. It's a video. It's art. It's meant to entertain and inform to a certain degree. So under that framing, I could see this falling into a First Amendment issue, most definitely. Again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not offering legal advice. But
did you stay at a Holiday Inn? Gee, what's your take?
I think that's supposed to be Holiday Inn Express, right? No, that's a good point. I didn't think about it from an artistic point of view. I did watch on X today, Gilligan's Island. You know, the beginning of Gilligan's Island, that music intro?
Yeah.
Well, they did it for Gilligan's Island, and Gilligan is obviously Kamala Harris, and she's like giggling throughout the whole intro. And I thought it was funny, and it is a form of artistic expression. I just go back to, we're, as a society, we're going to get used to deep fakes and, you know, fake videos. I watched, my friend showed me this one from about 5 months ago, Biden. He was giving a speech and he literally just said, and if you didn't understand what I said, that's exactly what he said. I'm like, and for about 20 seconds, I'm like, that's gotta be a deep fake. That's AI generated. Like, he didn't really just mumble a bunch of nothing. It turned out that's what he did.
It happened to me too recently. I'll be watching like these crazy clips and I'm like, no, that wasn't real. That was a joke someone put out.
Right.
But just like that, it's sometimes these, I know, it's a weird time we're living in.
Yeah, so our skeptical meter is just always on edge right now, right? So now, for example, X, thank God Elon Musk bought it, but now the community can say, I'm going to fact check this collectively. And I've seen stuff on the left and right, both fact checked, which I'm glad, because I don't want to run off with something that I want to be true and it's not true. So I'm very skeptical when I see something on X that fits my point of view until I know it's verified, at least independently by two other sources.
No, I agree.
It's like a little bit of a trick, though, isn't it? Because doesn't it sound really good? Like, I'm looking out for you. I want you to hear the truth. I don't want you to get misinformation. So it's deceptive in that way. Because while it's like, on one hand, it feels like it's a really good thing and someone's trying to protect people from getting the truth, if there is such a thing, you know, from getting something that's real and something that you can trust, is what I really want to say, something that you can trust. That's where I think the deception is, because it's also at the very same time extremely an infringement upon our rights and overreaching. That's the issue. The issue is in the deception, because it actually, that's why it took me a second, William. I'm sorry, I had to run to the bathroom, but it took me a second because I'm thinking, wait, this actually seems like a good idea in some ways, right?
Oh, they always do seem like good ideas on the surface. Yes. You know, again, going back to G, reminding us of Ronald Reagan, when the government says, I'm here to help, run. Big John actually chimed in, and I forgot about this. He's absolutely correct. I've never heard it officially stated by the courts, but analysts and pundits always talk about political, and, you know, lawyers always talk about political speech generally enjoys broader and stronger 1A protection than artistic speech. So does journalism, meaning, I mean, we've seen some cases that should not have been won by the media, one, because the courts want to protect the First Amendment for not only the media, but also political speech. I want to get, so we're closing this out, and I'm going to get final comments, but I want to get final comments. I found the Kamala parody ad. This is just too good, people. You know, so I will interrupt it for a couple of takes here and there so Big John doesn't sit there and beat me over the head, because he's right. You know, some of these copyright things, so I'll pause it a couple of times here, but let's take our popcorn and enjoy Kamala, the parody. But just remember, we don't really need an AI to see her parody at times. So this is a Kamala deepfake video.
I, Kamala Harris, am your Democrat candidate for president because Joe Biden finally exposed his senility at the debate. Thanks, Joe. I was selected because I am the ultimate diversity hire. I'm both a woman and a person of color. So if you criticize anything I say, you're both sexist and racist. I may not know the first thing about running the country, but remember, that's a good thing if you're a deep state puppet.
Okay, first of all, at this point, I think even the dumbest of persons can tell that it's a parody. You know, but it does sound like her. Is there anybody who disagrees in the sense it doesn't sound like her? Are we all in agreement? It sounds like her.
Not enough laughing, but yeah, pretty close.
Yeah. Okay.
4 years under the tutelage of the ultimate deep state puppet, a wonderful mentor, Joe Biden. Joe taught me rule number one, carefully hide your total incompetence. I take insignificant things and I discuss them as if they're significant. And I believe that exploring the significance of the insignificant is in itself significant.
Talking about the significance of the passage of time, right? The significance of the passage of time. So when you think about it, there is great significance to the passage of time, and there is such great significance to the passage of time.
Another trick is...
How significant is this parody?
And that one bit there was real. That was a real clip.
Well, at the very end, yes, it was, but it was added on. But, and G's right, compared to the Gavin Newsom, this one wasn't funny until they got to the word salad is significant, because that embodies who and what she is as a candidate.
Trying to sound black. I pretend to celebrate Kwanzaa, and in my speeches, I always do my best Barack Obama impression.
So hear me when I say, I know Donald Trump's tight.
And okay, look, maybe my work addressing the root causes of the border crisis were catastrophic, but my knowledge of international politics is truly shocking.
The United States shares a very important relationship, which is an alliance with the Republic of North Korea. It is an alliance that is strong and enduring.
And just remember, when voting this November, it is important to see what can be unburdened by what has been. And by what has been, I mean, Joe Biden.
Okay, I admit, geez, right, that was not anywhere near, on a scale of 1 to 10, that was a 2 compared to the Gavin Newsom. The Gavin Newsom, I was laughing. I mean, because we're affected as Californians. I shouldn't have said that with the Newsom and the new law. But the point is, it sounded like, I think that's what they're trying to avoid. They're trying to avoid, because what these parodies do, and this is where Big John's so smart. I remember studying this, and I can't say it like I studied it, but it's like parodies and satire. It really actually reflects the reality of the situation in a comedic format, in a way that mocks the person. Yeah. And I think that's what Democrats really loathe. I mean, you could do one on Trump. But the truth of the matter is, I'm a Trump supporter, but Trump's kind of a caricature of himself. The real Trump is at times, you know, and whatever it is, it's the greatest. I mean, that's just his own shtick. So I think being a parody of Trump, you don't really need to. But I think at its core, that's what the Democrats are afraid of, is that this satire, that satire and parody truly reflects where the Democrat Party is at times. And people are going to say, oh, William, you're being an idiot. No, I'm not. You actually look at their policies. You look at what they do. You look at how they implement it. These parodies here can be truly detrimental. Mm-hmm. Gee, let's start it off with you. Thoughts on this, on the overall situation of this law, on the parodies. Where do you see this going? And what do you think is the right avenue to take on this as a society? And you kind of alluded to it already.
Yeah, I mean, I think just allowing people to self-police themselves. I mean, here's the thing. When you have both Kamala saying Elon lost his privilege to free speech, which is dangerous, and then Hillary also coming out, I believe it was last week, saying that, you know, there should be someone overlooking what's being said to punish those who are saying the, you know, giving out misinformation. The problem with all of that is, what's the arbiter of misinformation, right? Who is the arbiter of that?
Mm-hmm.
Difference of opinion. Well, okay, I'm right, you're wrong, right? And then you got a totalitarian scenario where you got one person deciding what's true and what's false. This one's a little more clear cut because it's specifically to AI. But again, you know, the First Amendment wasn't written by the founding fathers to protect an artist, right? To paint a mural on the side of a building somewhere. It was to protect people from when they're speaking out against the king.
Yep.
Or when they're speaking out against their elected officials, since they had just come from under the king, and they said, okay, we got to protect you guys because you should feel free to criticize us any way you want. So I think it's terrible. I think it will be struck down by the courts. I'm not really worried about the law.
You know, I'm not neither. I'm not, and it's a great point you bring up in terms of that's what free speech was meant to protect, the media and Americans speaking out against authoritarianism, against government. To me, it's like the Second Amendment. Well, how many shots do you need to kill that deer? It doesn't matter. The guns are meant to protect us from you, Mr. Government. You know, so they're good at the left is good at shifting the goalposts there. Miss Annette, your final thoughts on this in terms of what we should do as a society, or what's the best way to handle it, and your overall thoughts on this law. Do you think it will get struck down?
I do too. I agree with G on that. I think they don't like it because it's effective. That would change people's minds. I think that sarcasm, some people will appeal to them, and I think they'd actually be like, that's sort of interesting. That could speak to them and potentially work as a way to get them to see through it. Do you know what I mean?
Like, right. It reaches them at a different level. Right.
Yeah. It would reach some people. It's an effective strategy, which is what they don't like about it. And so that it's, yeah, I actually am not worried about it either. I think it's going to get struck down. And
Mr. Tyler, you get the final, I always have the final word, but you get the final word out of the panel on this topic. What are your thoughts? I mean, and you actually, Tyler, you've actually said it the best, in my opinion, to give you some props here in terms of how you broke it down with the artistic look there. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought of it that way neither. That was a great example. So your final words on this topic is let me put it this way. Where should society go when it comes to this new era we're entering of AI and making everything look so real? And I assume you think this law will be struck down too.
So I think this law is going to be struck down on First Amendment grounds for sure. I hope it's struck down as quickly as possible. And second, talking about the new era we're entering in, this is still a scary era. And the scary part is not the parody, because we know it's parody. But when you have someone who's maliciously putting out content with the purpose of deceiving. Now, I don't think a law is going to address that. First, because who is the arbiter of what is true and what is false? There's a lot of questions about that, and I don't think we want to go there. And second, is the malicious actor even going to follow that law? Would that law simply punish law-abiding citizens? I think that's an open question. I think the real solution that you're looking for is a technological solution. We have technology, which has enabled the generation of AI. In the same way, I think we can have technological countermeasures to this. We can have algorithms and software which are able to detect things. And through features like community notes on Twitter, people can say, hey, we ran this through this program, some trusted journalist, whoever it might be, on the left or the right or whatever it is, have open sourcing of their evidence saying, we analyzed this clip. We feel with 99-point-something% certainty this is AI. And in the marketplace of ideas, the theory would be that that rises to the top and people become aware. But I don't think a centralized government solution is A, moral, or B, effective. I think it's much more scary to go down that route. So
I agree. The person who determines misinformation is the people in power. You know, that's why Democrats, because they have the media on their side, they're saying this is misinformation. You know, it was the Russia hoax, the Charlottesville lie, the threat to democracy. Every lie that is misinformation can be squarely put on the Democrat Party right now in terms of the major threats to America. Sure, Donald Trump says I'm the greatest or this is the greatest, but that's like a parody on itself. I'm not defending him as much as like the terribleness is coming from the party that says we need to have some kind of a bureau of misinformation. You know, I will default to what Tyler said, but I will also add once again education. Anybody who's been educated properly, who reads, who has been taught how to critically think, can look at a video like that and determine. Tyler, you are absolutely correct. My one fear are the ones that border on that line, purposely looking to deceive, but then hide behind the First and 14th Amendment. You know what I mean? Those are the shysters. But again, education and ability to critically think should be able to expose it. We're not perfect. We're not Jesus. You know, so we're always going to have a swath of society that isn't able to discern from that, which is why we put so much emphasis on our leadership, which has failed us. But again, we have failed ourselves by not educating ourselves to properly select our leaders. And with that, everybody, thank you for listening in. But before we go, Mr. Tyler Collins, Carlsbad City Council candidate, please tell us a little bit about yourself again, where they can find you and where they can go to donate.
Great. Thank you for that. So again, my name is Tyler Collins. I'm running for Carlsbad City Council District 2. So I am fighting for the values of the old Carlsbad, talking about Bud Lewis and Matt Hall. This is getting into some real Carlsbad stuff here, but these are former mayors of the golden days of Carlsbad. I want to bring back the values of the old Carlsbad. I want to bring a strong sense of accountability and transparency. Watch out for what makes our community special. If we keep building and building and building in our downtown and in certain areas, we're going to lose our community character and what makes us special here. So that's what I want to advocate for. And if you want to donate, I would appreciate any donation. You can go to collinsforcarlsbad.com. That's F-O-R, so collinsforcarlsbad.com. You can make a donation or message me there. My line is always open. So thank you again, William, for having me.
Outstanding. Miss Annette, real quick, tell us about your wonderful book and where they can find you.
Oh, can I just say I loved having you on the show, Tyler. You have my vote.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
I'm the president of the Rancho Santa Fe School Board, running for re-election, and I wrote a memoir, Where Fairy Tales Go. You can find me on this Twitter, at Annette_Ross5, but I'm not on very much. I'm getting there, William, slowly but surely.
Yeah, and I apologize. You're running for office, too, and I treat you just like a regular Joe. Just a man there, and I treat Tyler all special, you know. You know us being. Yeah, no. Gee, sir.
It's just because I have a cup. He treats me a little special.
There you go. Oh, I love that cup. Taking me for granted, William.
I'm looking for my cup.
Oh, no. And I have him here. We got to meet. We'll meet sooner than later, I promise.
Fair enough. You can find me on X at RSFG. I'm not running for office right now because I'm serving till 2026, so I'm good there. But, yeah, it's been a fun night.
Outstanding. And a big thank you to Big John, our producer, as well as his own words chiming in. You can find this podcast Fired Up, as well as our other ones. I'll pump it up again. We have our last libertarian podcast, the Pump It Up, was on freedom of speech, or free speech. It's extremely important. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican, a Democrat, or whatever party, Green Party, Schmaw Party, whatever. It's important. It's about our freedoms and how they're being lost and taken by the government that's supposed to help us and protect us. You can find those podcasts at grumblingsmedia.com. You can find us at our social media platforms to listen to these podcasts, specifically Rumble, YouTube, and Apple, Pandora, and Spotify under the handle Grumblings Media. To everybody, thank you so much for listening in. And until next time, I am William Del Pilar for the panel here, and I bid you adieu.